Lucy Duncan.
And Rob Pegler.
Where do you live and where did you grow up?
We live in West Philadelphia, and I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
And I grew up in the suburbs of New York, Westchester.
When you meet somebody and they ask that very American question, so what do? What's your go-to answer?
What I say is we have a business called Reparation Works that supports white leaders and organizations in moving towards reparative action. And sometimes I'll talk about being a storyteller. Sometimes I'll talk about some other elements of my identity.
Makes me want to wax poetic. My work is what? Making my soul, my corporeal being, and my financial self all sustainable in the healthiest possible way, which I suppose is what we do at Reparation Works for everybody.
Exactly. In addition to what you do, what are other identities that are important to you?
My other identities that are important to me are being queer. It's a pretty elemental to who I think of myself as being. The reason it's important is because I think that there are so many societal boxes, and queerness is a really wonderful laboratory for me in terms of breaking a lot of that societal boxes down. Being a storyteller is really important to me. My parents were a storyteller. My mother was a storyteller. My dad was a writer. And that has been really important to who I understand myself to be, working with narrative, working with shifting narrative. And our relationship to one another is we're in addition to business partners, we're also life partners.
Yes, we're business and life partners. And I'm turning the question over in my head, like which identities are most important to me, and then which identities are kind of like the most salient determinant, like when I walk out of the front door of my house. But in the order that they popped up into my mind, my identities, I thought, okay, well, I'm an animal that's living in West Philadelphia right now. I'm African American. I'm male identified and socialized as a male person, which matters. And I could keep going, but those are the big ones that come to mind right now.
This is, really a primer for people. I imagine that whoever is listening knows very little about reparations. These are not the folks who know awful lot. And so they know the word, they may know the concept that has something to do with slavery, and that's about it. So for someone like that, what's one way to understand or describe reparations for you?
Okay. Lucy and I were just chatting and looking at some notes we took for a conversation we had with Quaker's Earth Care Witness, and I was reading their mission statement, and their first line of their mission statement resonated with me, which is something about being in right relationship with all of God's creation. And especially if someone does not already have a definition of reparations in their head, I think that's great, because then you can have a better, more fully dimensional definition to start with, instead of unlearning not so helpful definitions. So if the question is, how can we be in right relationship with ourselves, each other, the earth, all our relations, what healing and repair needs to happen in order to do that? And then if you happen to live in contemporary United States, legacy of chattel slavery and colonialism, settler colonialism, are key core things that need to be healed and repaired. So reparations is, I guess, healing all of that, starting with the most vicious pieces that keep the machine spinning. Over to you.
I think reparations is is all of what Rob has said. It's also, it's one of the definitions that we use is that it's healing and repair on the levels of spirit, resources, and relationship. And so it's for me, it's an alchemical agent that when I started working on reparations, having done racial justice work for so long, I'm like, oh, this unbinds all this blocked energy. And it seems like it really is root work. It's getting at the root. And it's particularly getting at the root when compensation is elemental, redistribution of wealth, land back is elemental to what reparations is. But I think another piece of it is really repair of the relations and repair of the spirit. So for me, as a white person, it's really another part, an identity that I think of as pretty important. And as an anti-racist white person, to me, it's a bridge to soul reconnection with myself and soul connection with other people, and that it takes action. It takes acknowledgement of the depth of the harm, whether it's transgenerational in my own family or if it's transgenerational among Quakers. It's really important to look at, okay, what harm did we enact in our ancestry, and did we benefit from, and how do we really do the repair of rebalancing the world by redistributing resources, but also of doing the healing work that's needed to do that. So in order to prepare somebody to do reparations, there's a friend of mine who talks about Reparations Summer, which is an organization that raises money, particularly for Black farmers. And what they talk about is that white people need to do the psychosocial work so that when you sign the check for reparations, your ancestors don't knock the pen out of your hand. So I think that's really, really important as a elemental part of what reparations is.
There are lots of questions that I'm sure people have about reparations that you've heard, you know, whenever it comes up. And I'm wondering what are questions that have been helpful for you to ask and explore? And if you feel like it, what are questions that you think are not as helpful, or, you know, you would want to reframe the questions that are often asked?
I'll start with the easy part. One of the basic things I hear when the people we work with who think about reparations, something that's often said is, it's not just about the check, but there's got to be a check. Like, it's not just about resources, but there really need to be tangible resources that are redirected. So that's holding the yes and but of that really clearly is a reparations question, which maybe reminds me of another aspect of reparations I think about. It's an ethos, a set of values, a way of living, a spiritual practice. It's not just a transaction. So really understanding that and practicing it, experimenting with it, it's a living question. It's a question you answer by living.
I think some of the questions that people ask about reparations are like, you know, this is, you know, this all happened so long ago. Why would you think about that? Why, you know, how can I be responsible for what my ancestors did? And for me, that question leads to like, oh, but you get to do this inner transgenerational healing work, and it's about disrupting the disconnection of whiteness, which begins with the self. So it's like, oh, but it's this thing, this medicine that is not only rebalancing resources, rebalancing what the harms of the past, it's also it's soul food for those who participate in it. And so I think that there's, you know, we Pat Gunn, with whom I work at the Truth Telling Project, talks about how, yeah, you know, you didn't do that. You didn't, you know, enslave people, but you benefited from the legacy of that. And she's like, what does that call to you? How does that call to you for your own life? And what do you want your life to be about? And so for me, it's really, it's like, don't we want to look at the past and integrate and move forward in a thriving way, in a way that the magic, I really think of it as a magic of reparations can help make possible. So it's really about, the Truth Telling Project says that reparations is the midpoint between truth and reconciliation. And I think of as Quakers, with the Religious Society of Friends of Truth, it's really elemental that we tell the truth about ourselves, about the complicity that we hold, and that we also do the work of repairing that. And that reparations is an agent which allows us to have real relationships. So the reason that they say that it's the midpoint between truth and reconciliation is that because of the depth of the harm, the depth of the societal harm, the depth of the transgenerational harm, there's not a real relationship. So reparations makes a real, genuine, and authentic relationship possible. So those are some of the questions that I think we can
Excellent. Get. I want to pause you for a moment because you may not be aware of this, but I think you need to change the battery on your smoke alarm.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Sorry, that's coming through. I'm going to go reset the central fire alarm apparatus for the whole house.
Is that a big deal?
No, it's not.
It's just my eagle ears hear it all, you know? I once interviewed a poet who was so brilliant, but he had this smoke alarm chirping in the background that he could not turn off. He just couldn't reach it. I can't remember the details. And so I just had to basically start the segment by saying, every now and then you might hear a little chirp. It's not heard. But I promised he'd get it checked after we were done. So don't worry about him. He's going to be talking. And so you told me the questions that are often raised that you address, that you redirect, you consider. What are the questions that in your own work have been really helpful in asking and considering around reparations?
I mean, I think the question, what does this really mean? And what does it look like? And what's possible have been really, really important. I mean, when we started to talk about reparations at Green Street Meeting, it arose from a long process of deliberating around racial justice. And for us, it was like, oh, there was a discovery that we had a lot of resources, a fairly large unrestricted reserve. And it was like, oh, is the use of our treasures, our monetary resources, is it in line with our commitments, our faith commitments and our racial justice commitments? And it became really obvious that we needed to like look at reparations as a way to make it in line with those commitments. And so the like what becomes possible when you put it into the mix as a frame. And in the case of Green Street, it was like, there was an awareness of Quaker complicity, Quaker complicity with being enslavers. William Penn was an enslaver and a slaveholder, an early slaveholder in Philadelphia, and Quakers helped to create the penitentiary system. And actually, Quakers were called to offer reparations in 1969 by the Black Economic Conference. And deliberated and deliberated and deliberated. Malcolm Kenyatta was the person who made that call. He went on a hunger strike, and the yearly meeting ended up only paying $5,000. And he said the $5,000 and minuted a commitment to pay $100,000, which they never paid. And Muhammad Kenyatta said, you know, you aren't honest about your history of racism. And this is an example of it. They chose Quakers because they thought there would be an easy win, which I think is, you know, interesting. But I think that when you actually lean into it it creates a kind of opening for possibility that wouldn't otherwise exist. And what Green Street did first was create a legal clinic to support Black homeowners in securing their housing wealth. And in the context of Green Street, Black members of the meeting are deciding, determining the use of those funds. And that will be the beginning. That's just the first year, what we did with that fund, those funds, we paid fines, et cetera. So I think that for me, it's like, well, what does it look like? What can it look like? I think the UN definition is a really powerful place to start. My coworker, Pat Gunn, just helped, who runs Jubilee Justice in Savannah and Underground History Tours. She led the campaign to rename Calhoun Square, which was named after an enslaver. And they have a campaign to rename it after Susie King Taylor, who was a Black Civil War nurse. And I think that is reparations. What's memorialized? What's in our built environment? What's shaping our understanding of space and of history? That's also reparations. So when you really look at it, it has these multi dimensions, including like non-repeat as one piece that, and guarantees of non-repeat. So the dimensions of it, like, those can be applied in many ways, but they're also really, really, multi-dimensional. Another story that I really love is, that in California, where there is a task force looking at reparations, which is really powerful, their report is really powerful. There was a campaign to return Bruce Beach, which was owned by African Americans and taken by eminent domain, to return Bruce Beach to the African American family that owned it. And now they have it back and they're leasing that beach to the city. So I think it's like people say it's not possible, but when you actually look and say, what could be possible? Let's look at that instead. I think it's a really powerful tool.
The question of what's possible, I feel, is very fruitful wherever you are in your reparations journey, whether reparations is new to you or you're part of the hipster reparationist avant-garde. The question of, okay, on the federal, state, municipal level, some people think of reparations and they just think government, you know, 40 acres and a mule. Well, on the federal level, there's HR 40 legislation to get a commission, the truth part of the truth, reparations and reconciliation. On the state level, as Lucy said, there's the California Task Force, and there are things going on the municipal level. There's Bruce Beach. We just heard about something recently in Providence, Rhode Island. And then there are faith communities, that level, Lucy talked about. That's within the realm of agency or possibility of a person or a small group of people. Lucy mentioned Green Street in Philadelphia, the Mayor's Commission on Faith and Interfaith Affairs that Lucy's co-commissioner of is working on a campaign to get 100 congregations involved. And we heard of a friend who's not rich at all, but on a personal level inherited some property and is seriously looking into what to do about the transfer of that property and that wealth in terms of reparations. So that question, what is possible? There are a lot of things that are already going on that are inspiring and can be copied. And just that question, like we don't know yet what's possible. And instead of being overwhelmed, like we're creating what's possible right now.
I like that a lot. And it kind of dovetails a lot with the work I do with climate change, because, you know, I think people can be so easily overwhelmed by what's not possible. And to put people into this space of imagining, and to kind of remove the blockages that, you know, automatically come up or are imposed on us, you know, can really open up a lot of possibilities that we never considered before. And I'm glad you brought up example of Green Street, which to me is just so moving to read about that and to learn about that. And at the same time, I think about what an outlier Green Street is within the North American Quaker world, being having people of color in it to begin with in a large number, and having money, which a lot of Quaker meetings these days, they feel that they're very poor and they're getting even poorer. And so in light of that, for someone who's listening, say in rural Pennsylvania in a dying meeting, I don't know, you may not have anything to say to that, but they'll hear Green Street and they'll be like, well, good for them. That's awesome. But we could never do that. We're just a small white group of people who are poor.
That's a great question. I think what people can do if they're, you know, a small group of people that's like poor, I think, again, it's an invitation and a provocation to imagination. And I think that the using principles of like getting connected to your local Indigenous folks or your local Black folks, and really like thinking about what's needed and how you can come along with that work. To me, there's an embodiment of accompaniment that is elemental to reparations, that you're like that you're working alongside people and figuring out what it is that they need and how you can support that. I think that's a really elemental way of thinking. And people may say, oh, there's nobody here. And I'm like, you can find them. There's a way for you to find the people that invisibility is a myth. Like you can, if you look around, you're going to find the people that you may need to support. And I think that there's lots, for me, I always think about it like thinking like an organizer, like what are the needs and what are the things in my sphere, like that I have influence over or that I can support in moving money. Like I may not have that many, you know, I'm middle class. I'm thinking about using my wealth in reparative ways, but I think that, that's limited. So what am I connected to? Like Green Street, like the Mayor's Commission, so that I can influence other work of repair and reparations. And also just, what does it mean day by day to live a reparative life? What does it mean to live a life that's centered in, I'm not going to replicate the, like in my case, my grandmother was very disconnected. She was very wealthy, but she was very disconnected from her grandchildren, from my mother, and caused harm. So just the commitment to not live a life like that, to live a life that's deeply in connection and guided by, you know, community needs is part of a reparative act. So I think that looking at the UN definition, thinking about that, there was one of the stories that I tell in the article is about Charlottesville, which was famously when they decided to take down the Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson statues. There was the Unite the Right rally that was violent and deadly. And they went through a long process in the city of like figuring that out and did end up taking them down. And the African American Museum in the town bought Robert E. Lee and has melted him down into ingots. And they're doing a community process to figure out what he should be turned into. That's reparations. The like, what do we make? How do we melt down the metals and the instruments of harm and create something that's really reparative? So I think that, you know, there's coming alongside people who are impacted by these transgenerational harms and figuring out what they need and asking them. And then there's where does your imagination lead in terms of this work?
So in imagining a hypothetical small Quaker meeting that's white and individually and collectively does not have material resources, and they have no idea what to do, one thing that comes to mind is the idea of anti-racism beginner's mind. Like they're starting at a great place. They're not showing up with money and resources and feeling that they're being driven by easy saviorhood. So that's one thought. And then the other one is I would love to do a weekend hackathon with that group of people. And it would be, how do we spend our white privilege hackathon? And you don't have to have money to show up somewhere and people recognize you're white, is a thought.
And I think that to build on that, that really reparations is about divesting from white supremacy and from white privilege. And how do you do that? What are the ways? There are multiple ways to do that. And Rob has a really great framework called Return on Divestment that like thinks about like when you divest monetarily, what is that doing? What kind of repair is it offering? But I think that we can do that in our day-to-day lives. What does it mean to divest from white supremacy? What does it mean to walk around in the world with that frame? And how do we actively lean into that work? And for me, reparations, when people say they want to work for racial justice, I'm like, what does that mean? And for me, reparations is a really powerful answer to what does it mean to work for racial justice.
So I have more than enough for the segment, and I think a good amount for the extra feature for people to listen to. So we've only got about 3 more minutes, and there's obviously tons more to say, but this is just an opening of a conversation. In the last 3 minutes or so that we have, what else would you like to add or say?
Well, for people who are new to this and something I'm thinking about exploring myself is the difference between reparations and restorative justice. If you can trace a direct line of complicity, that's reparations. If things are more systemic and amorphous, but you or your group is still benefiting and is complicit, that's restorative justice. So, actually having owned somebody's ancestors, reparations, benefiting from the GI Bill when other people weren't allowed to, restorative justice.
Reparative justice.
Reparative justice. Sorry, reparative justice. See, I'm imperfect too.
What would I say? For me, this process of stumbling upon and really committing to reparations has been like deeply, deeply transformative. It's been, having worked on anti-racism and having, done the trained people and worked with other white people. It feels like it's a gateway. It's an opening to something, to another world. And so what I would say is like that reparations does the deep root healing work, calls us into the deep healing work that can allow us to have a new kind of world, whether that's, giving land back to Indigenous people so that it's cared for, and stewarded really, really well, and not part of the industrial farming industry, or whether that's honoring the stolen labor and long-term harms of Black folks that got brought here against their will and trying to make amends for that. It just feels like it's a powerful agent for transformation, transmutation, if you like.
I am so happy we've had this conversation. It's cleared some things up in my own head. It's given me a curiosity and an enthusiasm about thinking about possibilities, because I do hear the voices in my head who clamor about, oh, this is too hard, this is too hard. It's just there. It's like this buzz, this collective thing. And I'm sure it's part of my own white privilege that it comes stirring up. But this is really helpful. I think it's going to be super helpful to folks who listen. So I'm going to stop the recording unless there's something you desperately have to add.
Oh, I think that reparations may be hard, but climate catastrophe and the decimation of the planet feel harder to me. And reparations is a tool for addressing that too.
Okay. All right.
And I just appreciate the opportunity to your questions fertilize our thinking. Thanks.
You're welcome.